From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland, California.
Concord.
Parkside.
San Mateo.
I live in Alameda.
Coming up, we hear how Oakland could lead the nation in gun control.
I just plainly say that we do not allow the NRA to dictate our public policy here in Oakland.
Then we meet the specialized chefs serving the entire animal kingdom.
Our squirrel monkeys, we have papaya in there. We normally get Mexican papaya. It's less expensive. The squirrel monkeys will not eat Mexican papaya.
And we'll hear how an Oakland woman transitioned from circus shows to comedy.
Doing a crappy open mic at a little cafe in Northern California was like way more terrifying than any trapeze show or acrobatics show I ever did.
More surprises ahead on Cross Currents. Stay with us. When President Barack Obama announced his executive order tightening rules on gun sales last week, he called on local governments around the country to step up.
All of us need to demand governors and legislators and businesses do their part to make our communities safer.
And Oakland is heeding that call. In a city with one of the highest rates of violent crime in the nation, local politicians are preparing to pass legislation that they hope will both protect their citizens and set a national precedent. KALW's Jeremy Dalmas reports.
Next Tuesday, the Oakland City Council will take their second and final vote on legislation to address gun violence. The first vote took place last week at the council's first meeting of the year.
All in favor? Any opposed? Any abstention? Noting none, that is an 8-0 vote.
They ended the meeting on a personal note.
This meeting will be adjourned in the memories of Dave Hindu Henderson, Dr. Francis Cross-Welsing, and Torian Hughes.
Torian Hughes was the grandson of Council President Lynette Gibson McElhaney. He was shot and killed last month in an attempted robbery in West Oakland. Her colleague, Councilmember Annie Campbell Washington, helped write the three gun ordinances that the city is considering in the wake of his death and the gun homicides of 76 other people last year alone. Despite recent high-profile local and national shootings, she says this legislation has been in the works for months.
And what I've said about that is it really does not matter what day you bring forward gun legislation here in our country. It's always going to be on the heels of some terrible gun death because we have an awful crisis in our country around guns.
The first new law is about security.
You will either, when you're in your residence, need to have that gun on you, on your person, or it should have a trigger lock or be in a gun locker.
The second law would require firearms in cars to be secured. According to the Oakland Police Department, around 300 firearms were stolen from vehicles between 2014 and 2015. The third law would make it illegal to have magazines that hold more than 10 rounds of ammunition.
No one needs a large capacity magazine in order to, for self-defense.
The new ordinances wouldn't affect law enforcement. But Councilmember Campbell Washington is working on separate legislation that would require local police to store their firearms safely in their vehicles. She wants the city's laws to be comprehensive.
And the more cities that take this action helps states then move on that legislation. And what I am hoping is that eventually it will turn into real action that everyone is clamoring for at the federal level.
Los Angeles has already passed similar legislation to Oakland, and Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom is hoping to put a gun control measure on the 2016 state ballot. But there's been some pushback. LA was sued by the California Rifle and Pistol Association, the official state branch of the NRA. Oakland's bill isn't even finalized yet, and the NRA has already sent a letter to the city threatening to sue. When I asked the NRA's lawyers for comment, they emailed a statement saying, in part, that, quote, "Until our society is willing to address the complex problems of violent culture instead of repurposing well-worn panaceas, we will be left with little more than politicians pandering for votes on the backs of tragic events."
I just plainly say that we do not allow the NRA to dictate our public policy here in Oakland.
Annie Campbell Washington expected the NRA's lawsuit, but she says that won't stop Oakland from moving forward. The council's final vote will be on January 19th, and the ordinances are expected to pass unanimously. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas in Oakland.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba, and we'll stay in Oakland for this next story. The Oakland Zoo has about 650 animals, including elephants, tigers, camels, and giraffes. They all need to eat, and their needs are always changing. They may not be asking for gluten-free pancakes, but that doesn't mean they always want what they're given. Reporter Casey Miner introduces us to two sisters whose job is to keep track of all that. In this episode of her podcast, The Specialist.
Our squirrel monkeys, we have papaya in there. We normally get Mexican papaya. It's less expensive. The squirrel monkeys will not eat Mexican papaya. Well, we actually had a lion who just had a dental work done, so she's on a soft diet, but she's not liking her regular food. They actually called it a lion repellent. Our vulture, Jeff, prefers black bunnies. So every time I open a box, if I find a black bunny, I have to put that aside in a separate box for him because that's his preference.
I'm Casey Miner, and this is The Specialist. Meet Stacy Kiles. She works at the zoo in Oakland, California.
I am the supervisor of the commissary.
If you had to sum up your job in two words, what would you call it?
That's interesting, two words. Maybe an animal chef would probably be the best word.
Stacy's job is to plan and prepare meals for more than 600 animals and meet not just their needs, but their wants. So when she hears things like, the squirrel monkeys only want Hawaiian papaya, or Jeff the vulture has a special taste for black bunnies,
I roll my eyes, and then I remember that I'm here for them, and then I just do what's needed.
It's only pretty recently that feeding zoo animals has required a specialist. For a long time, animals just kind of ate what was available. Some zoos took their cue from circuses, others from agriculture. So think peanuts and hay. Animals often died of malnutrition or suffered severe vitamin deficiencies. In the 1920s and 30s, a researcher named Ellen Corson White made the first real effort to fix this problem by feeding animals at the Philadelphia Zoo a dense mix of grains and oils she called zoo cake. It was a hit, and the era of balanced diets began. Now, just as zoos have evolved to be more about conservation than display, animal diets have become, yes, more specialized.
So the first 2 hours of the morning are mainly spent just putting the diets together.
That means chopping 5-gallon buckets of eggplant and celery for the elephants, using big metal loppers to cleave up pork bones for the tigers, and carefully arranging frozen mice on beds of seeds for the birds. Every animal's diet is laid out on a sheet of paper in a binder that's kept up to date with their most current likes and dislikes.
Right now, Michelle's getting the pinkies and the fuzzies for the spoonbills.
Michelle is Stacy's helper for the day. Spoonbills are big wading birds, kind of like storks. And pinkies and fuzzies are frozen one-day-old mice and slightly older frozen mice. And yes, those are industry terms. Incidentally, the company that provides the mice promises that they will be shipped to you frozen in such a way that they can be easily split up, meaning there are no, and I quote from the website, mouse bricks or rat blocks to pry apart at feeding time.
Hyena diets look like they're done. So I will actually, you can come with me, we're going to do the camel diet.
Diet is zoo speak for meal.
Get my camel sheet.
The zoo kitchen isn't anything fancy. There's a big steel prep table in the center, lots of buckets and Tupperware, and way more walk-in refrigerators than I'm guessing your kitchen has. There's two. One is extra large, plus a walk-in freezer. Most of what's in there is fruits and vegetables, since that's mostly what the animals eat.
But there are also some real specific extras, including a cardboard box labeled, I'm not kidding, Black Bunnies for Jeff. You remember Jeff the Vulture? Altogether, they go through 10 tons of food a month. 10 tons! Close to a third of that is just for the elephants.
All in all, the whole entire zoo is about 1,000 diets a day, because there's more than one feeding. I know the elephants get fed 6 or 7 times a day. Most of the primates get fed 3 times a day, just like we would. They'll have their breakfast, they'll have their lunch, and then they'll have their dinner. And then I know with the chimps, they'll have their evening snack before they go to bed.
One thing the chimps like, cinnamon raisin bagels, toasted.
They're pretty much like us in their foods, so the keepers are really, they go out of their way to make it. Oatmeal, I know my sister actually makes them applesauce from scratch. She works here, she's one of the lead keepers up there. So yeah, I notice a lot of our items from home. Our Vitamix comes here to make their smoothies, our rice cooker comes here to make them rice on occasion.
Good morning. Good morning.
Once all the food is prepped, we load everything into a golf cart type thing and drive it up through the main zoo to deliver it to where Stacy's sister, Danielle, and her rice cooker await. The zoo's open now, and there are kids running around, birds screeching, and monkeys singing. Driving around with all this food, I get more excited than usual to ask Danielle the question lots of radio people start their interviews with to make sure our recorders are working.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had Cheerios with sliced bananas.
What did the baboons have?
Vegetables. Yeah, boring vegetables.
Danielle's in another kitchen up near the baboon enclosure. And when I meet her, she's just getting ready to feed them their lunch. She's got big bowls filled with broccoli, tomatoes, celery, squash, cucumbers, carrots, and sweet potatoes. When she's done assembling those, she makes them their toys.
Toilet paper tubes, empty toilet paper tubes filled with popcorn. A favorite. You know, they're in captivity. They were raised in captivity, so I just try to make it nicer for them.
Remember, Danielle's the one who brings in the rice cooker and the Vitamix from her house. Sometimes she puts hot sauce in the animals' meals, just to give them some extra kick.
Sometimes I'll bring in flour, just plain old wheat flour, put it in a tub outside, and it's like Christmas. They just sit there eating the flour, and it's like, whoa. And their mouth's all floury, and they get some water and make some pasty wadge. It's yummy. It's yummy to them, and it's funny, because I open the door, let them out. The one chimp male just starts screaming to let everybody know, we've got flour today. Look, there's flour. Okay, so I just need to bring them in.
The kitchen is right next to the baboon's night house, where they sleep and sometimes come in for food when Danielle needs to get out into their exhibit. It's an elaborate Rube Goldberg kind of setup with elevated passageways and sliding doors that help the keepers move the baboons from place to place. They're aggressive, and she's never in the cage with them.
So, you want to stay.
Once we're in, Danielle starts opening some gates and closing others, then handing pieces of food through the bars. And here, listeners, I must issue a disclaimer. Baby baboons are really, really, really cute. Distractingly cute. They jump around and make faces and do handstands, and probably 3 times Danielle had to tell me that whatever they were doing was threatening to warn me off of leaning in to coo at them, because they do not look threatening. All that to say, I tried very hard to stay present and focused while recording the baby baboons, but it was not easy because they're so cute.
Can you tell me their names?
We don't like to, because people tend to yell them their names when they're out visiting.
So, dear listeners, please don't do this.
But Martin, Mocha, Maya, Mimi, Maud, and Maru. That's little Kabili and Krista.
Once they're all inside and eating, Danielle heads outside into their enclosure to scatter more food, the vegetables and popcorn toys she was making earlier, which later the baboons will have fun foraging around for. It's an open, sloped, grassy area with scattered tree trunks and tall rocks they can climb up. We tromp around together while zoo visitors gape at us from behind the fence. It's pretty awesome.
Do you feel like you have individual relationships with any of the animals, either the baboons or any of the other ones?
Yes, definitely with the chimps, because we are, the keepers are part of their social group. Since they are so social animals and close to humans. What am I trying to say?
She's struggling to articulate it, but here's what I think she's getting at. If you're feeding the animals, you're a lot closer, and you have a lot more time to form a bond. Most people's daily contact with animals is dogs, cats, maybe the occasional bird or ferret. We see wild animals on TV, or yes, in zoos. Even then, though, for most of us, standing outside looking in is as close as we're going to get.
Some like you more than others, and it takes a long time. People don't realize that for them to accept you. It took like almost 8 years for one of them to stop grabbing me and about as much time for another one to stop spitting at me. It's a wonderful feeling, but it's, I don't know. I don't know if that answered your question. Now I will let them out and they will run amok like they've never eaten before.
Once we're done, we go in and the baboons go out. But they keep coming back to the fence to see Danielle.
Of course, they think I have food most of the time. Hi, Dink. This is one of our older females. I don't have anything, sweetie. I am their servant, their maid. I'm their cook. I do whatever they need. I clean up after them. I cater to what their needs are. I try and watch and see what their needs are. And do the best that I can to give it to them.
The music in that piece was by Seth Samuel, who also mixed the episode. Special thanks to the writer Mary Roach, who used to do public affairs for the San Francisco Zoo and shared this behind-the-scenes tidbit from her time there.
If you had a job as an elephant keeper or a hippo keeper, because you were dealing with large volumes of animal feces, you were paid a little bit more money for having to deal with that. They called it a differential.
You can hear more episodes of The Specialist on iTunes and Stitcher or right on our website at kalw.org. Listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The 15th annual Sketchfest Comedy Festival is underway in San Francisco. It combines stand-up, sketch, improv, and more from around the comedy world. That includes local talent, too, like Oakland-based stand-up comedian Krista Fatka.
You only really learn that you're a female comic by going to open mics, doing shows, right? And being introduced over and over again as a female comic. Which, yeah, you hear how that sounds? Sometimes it sounds like a warning a little bit. Like, hey guys, sorry, we gotta do this at least once a night.
Fatka has been doing stand-up for just about 2 years now. Her entry into showbiz was not what you'd expect. Here's KALW's Audrey Dilling speaking with Fatka in our studios.
I want to start talking about how you started out, which was as a circus performer. Can you just tell me how you know, where you discovered that and why you ended up doing
Yeah,
that?
I was always pretty gymnastic as a kid. And then I was kidnapped by some carnies, basically my friends, like, in Europe started training with a circus and performing with them, and they were like, you should come out. And we were basically living in this huge squat and throwing big circus shows there, and that was my introduction to the circus. And then I came back here and just trained for 10 years and taught kids and performed for a good long while.
So what was a part of your act?
I did mostly static trapeze and acrobatics and dance.
And so then how did you transition into stand-up?
So I think towards the end of my illustrious circus career, I injured my back. And I had kind of started playing around with doing like comedic monologues, but they were always kind of in character. And I would use props and doing that in a circus context at like cabaret type shows. And I knew I wanted to be funny, but it was like too scary to be myself doing it, or like the circus just felt familiar to me. So I like took a clowning class. I thought I was a clown for a while. Then I just started writing these things. A friend of mine started doing stand up, and I started writing in my own voice and more for stand up.
Was there a moment when you felt like a little bit more comfortable being yourself, or?
I don't think I've made it there quite yet. And it's funny, people who know me really well, they see what I do as a character. It's definitely part of me, but it's like a caricature of a part of me, I guess.
In what ways is stand-up like a circus, if any?
It's really different, actually, because it's so immediate. I mean, you could train trapeze for many years and your teacher could be like, you're not ready to perform, or, you know, but you still call yourself a trapeze artist. And with comedy, it's like day one, you're in front of a microphone and some people, and you're doing it, and you're immediately a stand-up comic by being funny in front of people, and you always have an audience available to you. Doing a crappy open mic at a little cafe in Northern California was like way more terrifying than any trapeze show or acrobatics show I ever did. So for me, the whole like first 6 months was really like not even really about jokes. It was just about getting over my own nerves and my own internal experience. And I still get nervous, but it's nowhere near what it was those first few months, especially. So.
And I've seen you make jokes about being a woman in comedy. Would you prefer to not have to be talking about that?
Yeah, I guess I would prefer to not have to. But then it's also like, I mean, we all have these lenses that we see the world through. And it's such a topic that many, many comics cover, the differences between men and women, the differences between white people and black people, and these things are like so done over and over again. But at the same time, like if that's the lens that you view the world through, and that's, you know, you don't really realize it until you go into the comedy world where like you are such the minority. If you're not a white male is like what most of the comics are, that like it does become more apparent to you that like, why is that? Why is this not welcoming to like, you know, more diversity? Like, what is it about the situation that that I am such a, so it comes up, and yeah, I feel like compelled to address it because so many people just have a huge blind spot about it.
Krista Fatka performs Saturday, January 16th and Thursday, January 21st as part of Sketchfest. More details about all the shows are at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. And we want to know what the latest news is in your Bay Area neighborhood. Loop us in. Our email is news@kalw.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. We love hearing from you, and we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Luisa Cardoza, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, and Eli Wirtschafter. Today's show was engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Don Catt. He says his sound is inspired by American hope and Native mysticism. Find out what that means when Don Catt plays Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco tomorrow night. Music starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.